Well, I see that we've got the flying spaghetti monster here, so we're certainly ready to begin. My name is Mark Lyon. I'm an intellectual property and patent attorney. My office is in New York City at the moment. I also do a lot of litigation, focus on a lot of different topic areas. First, a disclaimer, I am an attorney. I am not your attorney. If you have specific legal questions, consult a licensed attorney in your local area. I do operate a very active referral help system, especially with programmers and those types of folks. If you need help finding an attorney, feel free to contact me and I'll be happy to get you in touch with somebody. We're going to cover warrantless wiretapping today, and the warrantless wiretapping that's been in the news all stems from the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act of 1978. It was originally enacted in October of 1978, and it provides procedures for physical and electronic surveillance and collection of foreign intelligence information. The goal is to target foreign individuals that are communicating either outside of the United States or communicating from the United States to outside of the United States or vice versa. There were major amendments in the 2001 Patriot Act that were intended to target terrorism. It was supposed to make the ability to track terrorists as they traveled around the world a lot easier, especially with mobile phones. That was one of the biggest concerns that they had at the time. There were additional significant changes that came in as part of the Protect America Act of 2007, but the Protect America Act was not renewed in February 2008, so it expired. And we reverted back to the laws that we had at the 2001 Patriot Act stage. We've recently had some new amendments. The FISA Amendments Act of 2008, I'll call it the FAA, passed on July 9, 2008. Why does it exist? It was created in 78 as a response to Nixon's extensive and unlawful surveillance program of political and activist groups. The concern was that the intelligence agencies were going to be monitoring people for purposes that were not going to help secure the United States, but were instead going to gather information against operatives of an opposite political party or people with dissident views, which is, of course, not something that we support here in the United States. So the law originally was designed to limit the scope of monitoring electronically through the phone system. Of course, in 1978, we had a much different communications infrastructure. So the law did not actually change until 2001 to actually catch up with some of the changes that had been made. It provided judicial and legislative oversight to what the executive branch had already been doing. Basically, President Nixon was authorizing the intelligence services to investigate anybody that he wanted and to gather any information in any way he felt needed. So this actually placed some restrictions. It allowed warrantless surveillance for up to 1 year, and then there was also provision that would allow 72 hours for a U.S. person before they would have to get authorization. That's since been extended, and we'll cover that shortly. The recent notoriety of FISA. In 2005, the New York Times highlighted the warrantless domestic wiretapping program that was ordered by the Bush administration. The article covered activities that started in 2002. It's later come to light that the Bush administration actually started this in about 2000. Pretty much as soon as they were there, they enjoyed this opportunity to...
They weren't there in 2000.
Right after 2000. Technical error there. I think that may be 01. Okay. Sorry. Claims the warrantless wiretapping violates the Fourth Amendment and also the criminal penalties, the FISA. That was one of the charges levied in the New York Times article and also many of the subsequent articles. And that... Later, the EFF was approached by several whistleblowers, as was the ACLU. They pointed out that various telecom facilities had installed splitting facilities that would route traffic into separate networks that were operated by the NSA and other government agencies. The Fourth Amendment protects your rights, and it's one of the original provisions that we added to the Constitution in order to make certain that our government would not be standing over our shoulders, much like many of the other governments in the world. FISA defines a foreign power. We're trying to limit communications with foreign powers. So foreign power is a foreign government. Any faction of a foreign government that's not substantially composed of U.S. persons. We're going to get to a U.S. person in a moment. A U.S. person is not just an individual. It actually develops further from there. any entity that's controlled or directed by a foreign government. And it also includes, oddly, groups that are engaged in international terrorism as a result of the 2001 additions, and foreign political organizations. Many people get involved in politics of a country of their home origin, in some instances. Those groups and your involvement in those might subject you to monitoring under FISA. And what is a U.S. person? That is a citizen of the United States, it's a lawfully admitted permanent resident, or a U.S. chartered corporation, LLC, or other entity that exists under the laws of the United States. FISA provisions offer several major sections: electronic surveillance, physical searches, PIN registers and trap and trace devices. PIN registers detect what you dial out on your phone. Trap and trace picks up what you receive on your phone when people call you. It detects the numbers. They're usually all used together and used interchangeably in a lot of legal terms. Access to certain business records, a reporting requirement where they were required to report the actual warrants that are issued. And it also created a special court that meets in secret that evaluates and generally approves requests for warrants. In 1980, there were 322 warrants issued. In 2006, with the most recent numbers that I was able to gather, 2,224 warrants were issued. From 79 to 2006, there were 22,990 applications made to the secret FISA court. 22,985 of them were approved. Some of them had substantial changes, but majority of them were approved, and 5 were outright rejected. Surveillance with a court order. There are 2 actual types of surveillance that are allowed. There's surveillance that's under the court order that comes through the FISA court, and then there's surveillance that comes without the court order. The Justice Court Department has to get an order from the surveillance, permitting the surveillance from the FISA court. The FISA court actually enters into a review of the facts that are presented to them, and that's one of the major concerns. The FISA court actually only hears from the Justice Department. It's much like getting an indictment. There's nobody involved other than the people who are claiming that you're guilty. So it's very easy to prove, with a very low burden of proof, that you should be tapped. And there are special provisions to protect U.S. persons, to limit the monitoring that we do of U.S. persons. And we basically want to make certain that they are involved in communications with the outside foreign entities. Surveillance without an order is where we get into a lot of trouble. The president authorizes general electronic surveillance through the attorney general for up to 1 year on an individual target. The attorney general makes a certification of the same requirements that the FISA court has to make, but the attorney general just has to say that those things exist. There are some penalties if they fraudulently make those certifications, but nobody's been punished for that. So it's sort of an empty tomb there. Criminal penalties and civil liabilities do exist, and special provisions exist for at the beginning of a war. If Congress actually declares war, they can essentially monitor everybody with no limitation, for the most part, for up to 15 days. So if Congress actually declares a war, the monitoring system could get quite interesting. They're allowed physical searches. They can actually enter onto your property. They don't have to tell you that they came or that they went or that they copied things, that they saw things. You're not allowed to be informed of it because it's part of the secret process, but they can look at premises, information, material, or property used exclusively by a foreign power. And the same warrant requirements exist for physical searches as do for the electronic surveillance. You have the two-track system. You can either go to the FISA court or get the authorization directly from the Attorney General. The FISA court oversees requests from federal agencies. Usually it's the FBI making the request. Your local police, if they want to get a tap on a phone, will generally request it through the FBI. It's a simpler process. There are 11 judges on the court. They serve 7-year terms. And all their proceedings are ex parte. Basically, the person that they're going to monitor has no notice that they're going to be monitored. So they have no right to be heard. They have no one arguing their side of the position. It's simply the Justice Department attorneys relying on the affidavits and the information they receive from the FBI to present to the court. The hearings are held in secret. There is no access to the information or records of the hearings. It is understood that there are records made. but no one outside of this process has been allowed to see them ever. Three-judge appeal panel has been used, I believe, one time in 2002. If the government is unhappy with the result they get from the judge that they went to the first time, they can then move up to a three-judge appeal panel. And transparency. We don't need no stinking transparency. This past Thursday, the FISA court denied a motion by the ACLU seeking permission to participate in the secret proceedings. ACLU had made a motion when the new 2008 rules were put in place that they wanted to have the ability to get transcripts of the proceedings, and they also wanted to have the ability to advocate for people who were being who they were seeking warrants on. They would not necessarily represent the specific individual. They would represent kind of the more global idea of protecting our privacies and our freedoms. That was denied. Judge Mary McLaughlin indicated in an 11-page opinion that the motion would create risks to national security that far outweigh any potential benefit to be gained by providing the ACLU with access to the requested records. And she went on to further talk about how that the ACLU's input in this process would be basically useless. Since they don't know the individuals involved, they really couldn't offer very much input that the court does not already consider. Before FISA, there were several court cases that established sort of the process and what was allowable with warrantless wiretapping. We had the Katz case. It was a it said that the Fourth Amendment applies equally to electronic and physical searches. This was moving from searching your house to listening to your phone. The Plamondon case, which is a 72 case, the court approval was required for domestic surveillance because of the Fourth Amendment. Basically, your Fourth Amendment rights do apply, amazingly. It's like the Constitution was written to mean something. The Brown case in 73 and the Batinko case in 74 upheld that warrantless wiretapping for foreign intelligent purposes, and this is where FISA sort of gained its original ground, were these two cases. And the Zwiebon case in 75, that a warrant was required to monitor a domestic organization. This is where we got to the U.S., to the person definition, where it also includes corporations and other entities here. I believe that that case was a charity that they were monitoring. I forget what the specific thing that it was supporting. After FISA, Dugan upheld the FISA as to the Irish Republican Army. They were monitoring communications of U.S.-based people who were communicating with the IRA. Nicholson moved on in 97 to reject a motion to suppress evidence that was gathered under FISA order. Basically, the warrantless information that was collected, they wanted to actually use in court to try to convict somebody, a guy named Nicholson, and he was unhappy with that, tried to prevent that introduction of the evidence, and it did not work. He was convicted using that evidence. And then the sealed case, it's a strange case, and there's not a lot of facts to support the actual findings because it's a lot of secretive information. But all the other courts to have decided the issue have held that the president did have the inherent authority to conduct warrantless searches to obtain foreign intelligence information. This looked at FISA and all the previous cases and basically said that the president has the authority to do what he was doing, which is to monitor people without gathering warrants from the FISA court for up to 1 year. FISA does not address the transition from circuit-based communication to packet-based. The globalization of infrastructure where your communications today from here in Atlanta might go through a system that routes it to Australia and then back around. It does not cover automated monitoring, data mining, or traffic analysis, but that hasn't bothered the government. They've been more than happy to use all the latest technologies to enhance their ability to track and monitor. There are some systems that they have out now where they're monitoring all the phone calls, systems, all the pins and traps, back and forth to monitor sort of a graph-type theory of your phone use and linking individuals who make certain phone calls together in order to decide that they're a terrorist cell because they all make the same phone calls. Yes?
One of the arguments for the 2008 amendment that the globalization infrastructure had communications passing through the U.S. that might not involve a U.S. person, what they were trying to leverage?
That was one part of it. And to that extent, it did help. But then at the same time, we have U.S. communications that are leaving the U.S. that would come back to the U.S. at some point as well. So we basically created a monster. And the 2008 amendments created a lot of issues. They reduced the oversight. It allowed us to allow the U.S. to propose a certification to the FISA court. Basically, the FISA court would decide that it was okay to monitor a certain class or a group. And then the Attorney General or the Director of National Intelligence then gets to issue authorizations with no practical limit on the breadth. So if they decide that these type of people are a certain group that we can monitor, then the Attorney General can issue wide sweeping authorizations to monitor all those people who fit into the group. It also allowed them to focus their monitoring on things other than direct telephone communications and data communications, to look at non-terrorist and non-external country type things, and also look at things like P2P file sharing. If you're using, say, a tracker in another country, suddenly you're communicating, breaking the laws in multiple states, and they want to monitor that. Or online gambling, which was banned by certain regulations here in the United States, but it might be legal in other countries, and then therefore you've got communication. So it allowed them to actually monitor that activity. It slightly enhanced the protections for Americans who live overseas. That was one of the vagaries of the original law. If you were an American, a U.S. person, and you were living overseas and communicating overseas, could they monitor that communication? That falls back in line with the communications that start outside the U.S., come through the U.S., and then may terminate in a third place. That helps out with the Americans who are living overseas. And it also extended broad retroactive immunity to telecoms who assisted in the surveillance effort. We'll get to that in a moment. That's one of the more interesting little points. It prohibited the use of the individual states from investigating, sanctioning, or requiring disclosure by complicit telecoms or other persons. Basically, if the government had given a telecom a letter that said what they were doing was acceptable under the FISA law, which the government did in the beginning to all the telecoms, regardless of whether the telecom knew that what they were doing was correct or not, they're absolved of liability. It permits the government not to keep the records of searches and to destroy the existing records. It was originally required to keep them indefinitely. Now they have a 10-year period where after 10 years they throw them out. Removes the requirement for detailed description of the nature of information or property targeted by the surveillance. That's one of the things that's generally required in a warrant, is that you have to particularly describe the things and the places that you're going to be finding them. FISA, we want things fuzzy so that we can grab everything, so we're going to do away with those requirements. It gave the FISA court 30 days to renew an existing order that was going to expire. So it basically gave 33 days in case paperwork takes a long time to process. What generally happens is you got 33 days. And it allows eavesdropping in emergencies without court approval, provided the government files the required papers within a week. It also extended the 72-hour deadline for monitoring U.S. citizens. They now have about a week to do that without notifying the FISA court. Yes?
Does that week have 30 days for the paperwork?
That's an odd point. It's not supposed to, but because you can't monitor what happens in the FISA court, nor can you ever appeal it, it depends on what they decide. Telecom immunity that we discussed earlier, EFF and the ACLU, through whistleblowers, uncovered evidence of substantial traffic diversion, specifically in one San Francisco data center, but there have been other data centers that have been apparently pointed out since that time. EFF brought suit against AT&T, which operated the San Francisco center, but the 2008 amendments basically gutted the lawsuit in its appeals process. I've been in contact with some of the EFF attorneys, and I'm understanding that they have found some procedural issues that weren't covered properly, and another path that they're going to progress. So you should look for some more things to happen with the EFF and the ACLU together in the coming months. If you want to find some really great documents, there's a 300 to 400 page affidavit from a guy, I believe, named Nicholson, who was one of the people who was actually a tech at this facility. He's got tons of pages of exhibits of telecom manuals showing how to install the fiber switching equipment that he was assigned to work with. And it's all included as part of his affidavit. It's great reading, especially if you were one of the kids like I was who liked to gather tech manuals and find out how things actually work. Mark Klein is one of the other, he's actually the gentleman who has the giant book of information. This is an excerpt from his affidavit, and this shows the connections that he was instructed to install in a splitter cabinet. He was actually taking the fiber optic cables that were going through San Francisco, carrying your phone calls and your communications, and to install a splitter cabinet and route the other end of it, one end to the same place it had always gone, but the other end to the secret room that was locked, that nobody had access to except this one group of people who came in and had their own keys. He was really suspicious of this. He spent a lot of time trying to figure out what was in that room, and he gathered a lot of information about what was actually there and what was going on. This is the 611 Folsom facility in San Francisco, and it was a pretty simple arrangement. Your general traffic would come through the facility. It went through the splitter. You know, a copy of it went to the NSA-controlled room, and then the rest went where it should. The NSA-controlled room had lots of equipment in there and was connected to a government network, and it essentially had access to all the phone calls and all the other information that traveled through that network. What you can do to try to limit kind of the advance, especially on the telecom immunity section of this, that's been one of the more pivotal points of the 2008 amendments. It sort of stopped any challenge to the FISA laws and their application. So contact your congressional representative and ask them to work to repeal telecom immunity. I don't hold out great hope for that at this point. Both presidential candidates supported the FAA, although vice presidential candidate Biden did not. He actually voted against it. Support the ACLU and the Electronic Frontier Foundation. They are always needing funds, other donations, other assistance. They have great websites that provide you with information about how to get involved. And then also protect and secure your own personal communications. If there is a large, massive monitoring operation going on, you creating a communication within that channel that they have to work with to decrypt, kind of like we had the communication earlier, makes their job a little bit more complicated and perhaps allows others the ability to communicate freely. Yes?
I started decrypting things and they realized I started decrypting things. Isn't that inherently suspicious and therefore draw more attention to me?
It may. And that's certainly something that you should want to monitor. I actually run Tor servers on a lot of the machines that I have access to, and I provide an outbound path for a lot of people who route traffic in other ways. And I know a lot of other people do that as well. It makes my traffic look very suspicious. And I have had one of my data centers wonder what was going on, and then I was actually able to get help with the Tor project. And we've worked on the legal side of that to provide notifications to your ISP and to provide registration with Copyright Office so that you have some shelter of immunity in case something were to happen with the traffic that was coming out of your system. And this is a section that I like to try to always include, law enforcement encounters. While some states require that you have to provide your name if questioned, I'm not certain if Georgia is one of those. You do have a right to remain silent if you're interrogated by law enforcement. That does not mean that you have to be sat in an investigation room. It can be simply being stopped on the street. Don't try to explain matters to the police. You're not going to convince them otherwise if they've made a decision. Invoke your right to remain silent by politely stating that I wish to invoke my right to silence and ask that I be allowed to consult with my attorney if after you ask them, can you leave, they say no. You can gain nothing by talking to the police if they have decided that you are a suspect in any sort of crime, including communications that violate all sorts of federal acts or that make you appear as a terrorist or anything like that. You're not going to convince them otherwise. The only thing you're going to do by talking to the police is convince them and provide more evidence against you. Don't be swayed by threats or intimidation. If they threaten to get warrants to search your house, to gather your computers, to look through everything, they can do that anyway. It doesn't matter if you talk to them or not. They cannot hold your failure to speak with them against you in court. Any statement that you do make will be used against you. Yes?
I want to point out that not only can it be used against you, but it cannot be used to help you. If in court your attorney tries to say, when you say this to a police officer, because it might help you out, they'll strike you down as hearsay.
That is correct.
It can't help you at all.
Exactly. The question was, was that the information that you do use can't be used to protect you in court, and that's one of the rules of evidence that actually prevents you from being able to use your earlier statement to prove up your position. Ask for an attorney, talk to your attorney, be open and honest with your attorney, but you have no reason to talk to the police. There is no benefit to be gained. A warrant is an interesting document. Many people don't know what it looks like because hopefully you've never seen one. It's a piece of paper signed by a judge that gives law enforcement officers permission to enter your home or another building to do a search, to gather equipment, to make an arrest, to do all sorts of activities. And the activity that they're going to be allowed to do is going to be spelled out on the face of that document. Search warrant allows the law enforcement officers to enter a place. They get to look and they get to take things that are identified by the warrant. You can be forced to divulge passwords at a certain point. They'll be able to gather the information that they're allowed to collect. An arrest warrant allows law enforcement officers to take you into custody. It does not give them the right to search your home. Yes?
Isn't there just a court case saying that you do not have to divulge a password or at least an encryption key?
I'm not aware of it in the states where I've practiced.
There was just a case that came out where somebody, I think it was a Fifth Amendment right in both.
There was some talk of a similar outcome in the San Francisco Terry Childs case, and he voluntarily gave up the passwords that he was holding in his head at that point. But I'm not certain of the specific case.
Is he the network admin?
He's the network admin in San
Francisco. This is something else.
Yeah.
I think a guy was entering the country with a laptop. They looked at it, they found some stuff that they thought was incriminating, they arrested him, they took his laptop, and then later they tried to get back into it, they couldn't. They tried to get him to divulge keys, and he wouldn't.
And he would not.
He won.
I'll definitely have to look at that. That's interesting. The laptop search issue is one that's going to become worse before it gets better. Basically anything entering from outside the country, the government has always enforced a right to be able to look at. It was different when you had a briefcase of documents.
We also have a talk about laptop searches.
So make sure to join that panel. That would be an excellent thing to come watch. There's definitely going to be some good information shared there. Tomorrow? That'll be tomorrow. Tomorrow at 1 p.m. Parts of a warrant. A warrant must contain a judge's name, your name and address, the date, the place to be searched, the description of the things to be searched for, and the name of the agency that is conducting the search or the arrest. In many states, the warrant also must have attached to it the affidavit from the police officer that they gave the judge in order to be able to get the warrant, which is a very handy thing to have because suddenly you know what the police know. You have the right to read and see that warrant before they're allowed to search. If it does not have your name on it, it may be still validly used if it describes you with enough detail to identify you. And a search warrant that doesn't have your name on it may be valid if it gives the correct address and a description of the place that the officers will be searching. It's sometimes hard to know who owns the property that you want to search, but they can certainly explain exactly what it looks like, exactly where it is, what the street address is. If law enforcement officers knock on your door, instead of opening the door, ask them at through the door whether or not they have a warrant. If they do not have a warrant, don't let them in your home. Once you let them inside, they have the ability to look around, and anything that's within plain view, they have the ability to convict you or arrest you on. You say that you don't want to talk with them. If the officers say they do have a warrant, ask them to slip it under the door. Or if you have to, crack the door ever so slightly. Don't open the door wide. Don't fling it open. If that's not an option and you feel that you've got to open the door and go out and talk to the officers, open the door, step outside, and close the door behind you. Lock it. If they're going to arrest you, they're going to arrest you on the stoop. They won't wind up coming in your house and searching your entire house for things that might have been around. There have been a lot of abuses with searches through various police agencies, especially in some smaller towns and some other areas. And the better you can do to head that type of stuff off the pass, the better you are. Tell the officers if the information on the warrant is incorrect, if they have the wrong address, if they have the wrong person. Tell them that they have the wrong information. But if you tell them that the information is not accurate and they say they're going to search anyway, Let them know that you're protesting it, but do not put up a fight. Do not fuss. Yes.
What are your rights as regarding recording all of this?
In generally, you're going to create a hostile environment, and it would be inadvisable. But any witnesses that you have around, any people that are there, any information you can gather about who was there, who actually did the search, the people that were in your house at the same time, people who saw them there, what they took, any information you can gather is good. But I have seen instances where people pull out a video camera and that escalates the situation into a situation that you don't want to be part of. Yes?
You said we have a right to read and handle the warrant and the attached affidavit. Do we have a right to retain that item, give it to a family member, any witness, so they can hand it over to our attorney?
In most states, no, but your attorney will be able to get a copy of it after the point. So. But most of the time they will have one copy and they will take it back. And at your first opportunity, make sure that you contact an attorney. If they arrest you, make sure to invoke your right to counsel, say that you want an attorney and that you do not wish to talk to them until you've talked to your attorney. And it's a good thing that we kind of ran long on the other panel because I ran surprisingly short while putting these slides together on the airplane. There are more documents and a lot more information out there about the warrantless wiretapping issues, and I've got links up, but let's take questions. Yes, sir.
On the telecom, I'm no big fan of Mott Bell here.
Yes.
But stepping back to the moment in which all of this happened, these companies live and die by their FCC, federal government regulations. What does the EFF and others who are complaining about this think the telecom should have done?
It is my understanding that there's actual discovery documents that have already been produced in the AT&T case where AT&T evaluated the legality of what they were doing and internally decided that they should not participate, but decided to anyway based on the strength of the letter from the government. They made a conscious decision to move ahead with their ability to allow the NSA to monitor systems, and took no efforts to warn their customers or to take any other steps to protect the people that were actually being monitored. That's one of the bases of the suit. There are several others. The AT&T actually violated several of their provisions of their agreements with their customers by allowing the monitoring. It's certainly a sticky situation. Yes, behind you.
Yeah, on that same note, be aware that if you work for a telecom, your immunity goes away with the telecom.
That is very true.
So if you install a switch, you install a piece of software that monitors or is used by the NSA, and the immunity of your employer goes away or is overturned, your immunity as well.
Generally, however, technicians, their liability, if they're following the instructions of their, you know, their corporate owners who are telling them what to do and they're not making independent decisions, their liability would be slight, if any. It would mostly go straight back to the employer.
There's several landmark cases involving system administrators,
mm-hmm.
and those who are responsible persons
When you make independent judgment managing a system and deciding how things are going to happen, you move into a managerial role and you do subject yourself to some liability. Yes, sir.
Didn't Quest refuse to do the warrantless wiretapping and was retaliated against through contracts being revoked?
I know that several of the providers did retaliate or did fail to comply, I think is how it was put.
This is coercion.
And they were... There were some activities taken against them. I've not seen specifically what happened to them. I know one of the cell phone companies also had a similar issue with peering agreements or something similar to that as a result of their failure to participate. Yes, sir.
Two parts. Is the violation of a civil right perceived as harm and is therefore actionable against as an individual? And secondly, the telecoms that did provide this information, if it was providing information, say, on me, and I have done nothing wrong, and I find out that I was subjected to this search, have I been harmed? Is that actionable?
Yes, you have been harmed. And whenever your civil rights are violated, that is actionable, unless we provide immunity or decide that the harm was so minor that it does not merit compensation. There are many things, you know, basic trespass, where somebody, for instance, was to walk onto your land. a casual person strolling down the street, that's not a great harm to you. But if it's a continual thing, then it can gather a point of harm where it actually bothers your fair use and of your land. Same thing with your communications and with your privacy. Privacy in the United States is not defined as clearly as your ownership of a piece of dirt. But we have the right to privacy nonetheless, and that right is becoming better defined as we develop through the law and as the Supreme Court cases develop. So, yes, you do have an actual right, and especially if you have an agreement with your phone company that does not allow them to take the action that they've taken, then you've definitely been harmed, not just on the basis of your rights, but you've also had a contract violation there. Yes?
Another two-part question. Is there a simple answer to the question of what's the difference between constitutional rights and civil rights? And is there a list or a book somewhere that talks about what we all agree to be our civil rights? Because the term civil rights can mean everything from get out of my email box to don't discriminate against me because I'm black. I mean, it can mean so many things.
There are several really good publications on your specific rights, and it's odd because so many of these things spring out of simple ideas like privacy. And based on privacy, you get stay out of my email box and medical procedures. It's such a wide swath of a category that so many different things can fit into. And it really has developed as the court goes. Supreme Court, the structure of our U.S. legal system, our Supreme Court makes decisions that the lower courts are federal district courts and the federal appellate courts have to follow. So cases that go all the way to Supreme Court have more authority than a case that might make it, say, the Fifth Circuit in New Orleans. That would impact cases that happen in those states, or in a state Supreme Court where it would only affect the cases that happen in that individual state. So the state of Mississippi might decide one issue differently than the state of Georgia, but the federal courts might decide a third way, and then the federal courts would supersede. So it's really kind of developed differently as the Supreme Court has gone on and better defined what they believe the rights to be. And the problem with the Supreme Court is that they're not certain from one day to the next what they think. And so every now and then we get great changes in the law, and it's always interesting and it's always fun, and that's what makes my job exciting, because we always have great changes. But it does make things confusing, especially for people who want to know, can I do this or can't I? Many times there's no definitive answer.
The answer is up to them.
Exactly.
First of all, are police allowed to lie about the law to you? And if they do, let's say, in the state of Georgia, you don't have the same thing for cops. The cop says, if you have your driver's license on you, you're legally required to show it to the court to see it. If they say something like that and you show it to them, are you, do you have any recourse at all against them?
Generally, for something that minor, you would not have much of recourse. But police are allowed to lie to you in any instance and situation.
It's illegal.
And exactly. The way that you would address that situation is after the fact. And generally, in your dealings with the police, you know, keep your mouth as quiet as it can be. Request an attorney if you're being held in custody. But if you're being instructed to do something, do it and contest it later. Make sure your attorney knows what happened, and that way he can address it at that point. If you try to put up a resistance with the police, bad things happen.
Don't tase me, bro.
Don't tase me, exactly. All the way in the back.
I was curious about cell phone SMS messaging.
Yes.
And wiretapping that. It's against the law for the government to read our emails, but there's nothing to stop them from
under FISA, they would have no problem monitoring those communications, and I've seen wiretap orders that have not been under FISA, just general court order that allow monitoring of text messaging and monitoring of email. It really depends on what's authorized by the court, but you should not assume that your plain text SMSs are any more private than your phone calls or any other form of communication. Yes?
One last question on the telecom immunity thing. Now that the 2008 amendment was passed, the immunity was in that bill, absent political changes, you know, us exerting pressure and the Congress and the President changing that, is it pretty much a finished issue now?
About 90% is settled and certain on the telecom immunity issue. I can't go into too much detail about what the EFF has planned right now, but I'm expecting them to have a novel idea of how to address it. I don't know how successful it's going to be. But absent political change, I think that is the right way to address it, and I don't see that happening at the immediate moment.
Most of the stuff we have been talking about focuses on the U.S. government. I have a question about foreign governments.
Okay.
Take a foreign-owned company like T-Mobile. What's to prevent them from taking a copy of huge amounts of their data, sending it to Germany, and then letting the German government run rampant with that data?
There are some limitations as their common carrier status in the U.S., how they have to treat their traffic. I am not fully versed in those regulations. But with any entity that is allowed to pass traffic anywhere in the world at this point, you do have to be aware that there can be other entities other than the United States government that might be monitoring it. If you're communicating with somebody in China, you should expect that the Chinese are monitoring your communications. And then perhaps anybody that's along the wire as you go through could be monitoring as well. Especially, things like email would be very easy to monitor if you happen to be watching the network for it and you have a nice big link going through your country. All the way in the back.
I'm interested to know, conspiracy theories aside and the obvious parts aside, why the government wanted some of these changes. Why do they want less oversight? Why do they not want to make these applications to the FISA court when the FISA court approves all but five of the applications that it's gotten in the past 30 years?
It's a speed issue, is what I've generally understood.
So they can start doing it before they actually have the approval from the court.
It's an additional administrative burden. And for the investigator out in the field who is wanting to very quickly find out what's happening, drug dealing is becoming one of the more popular reasons that you get a wiretap. Murders are very unlikely to get you a wiretap, but drug dealing is a very good one. Wiretaps are not cheap. The cost goes down the more you do. As with anything that you buy in bulk, it was around, I believe, $60,000 or $70,000 to tap for, a 6-month window about 5 years ago. That figures down to about $40,000 now, is my current understanding on the dollar cost. And then if you add in additional legal overhead and burdens, you've got additional costs there. But if you do it through a drug case and you wind up having a drug bust where there's $1 million sitting aside in one of the people's houses that you arrest, you've suddenly paid for a lot of your wiretaps. So they're actually doing some cost-benefit analysis with their wiretaps, and they're focusing on areas where they can recover money and funds that they can then seize. Yes?
Nichols set the precedent that you can use FISA wiretaps for anything other than terrorist acts, right? And you said are they using FISA for drug busts?
They've begun using it for drug busts. If you're dealing, say if I'm a cocaine dealer here in Atlanta, I've got to have my supply in another country. It's generally difficult to get large quantities of cocaine made in the United States. So I'm going to have international communications. And if they record something incident to my international communication that deals with my local distribution network, or if they put that together through my PIN registers or one of the traps, then they can use that information that they gathered in that way.
But the NSA has all communication, at least from San Francisco?
That's the understanding at this point, is that...
So is that... There's purely domestic communication going on there. They can use that also?
As an outflowing part of the international monitoring. Now, there is a local U.S.-based monitoring that has been allowed by Congress that lets them monitor the phone numbers you dial out and the phone calls you receive. And that's just the numbers. That's not the actual content of the communication. And they're allowed to use data modeling methods to look at that information and try to determine who you communicate with and who those people communicate with. And if one of those people winds up on the list that they're monitoring, then they might impute the behavior of that person upon you. So be careful who you call.
Are the telecoms currently required to keep information, or can they willfully, oops, I deleted it?
most of the time, the way that we're seeing with, you know, the Folsom system and some of the others, they're actually co-locating their equipment in the phone's company's closets. And
it wouldn't matter.
It doesn't matter. The government is getting the data as it happens. They're not getting logs.
They did this voluntarily. This isn't something they were forced to do. So it's not like they want to delete this data.
Well, you say they weren't forced. I mean, they could have been coerced.
There was some definite coercion going on from all the documents that are out there. This was not something that they decided, hey, let's give information to the government. The government came and asked, and they didn't forcibly say no. They sort of went from there.
You mentioned that a U.S. corporation can be considered a U.S. person?
Correct.
If an agency is granted permission to spy on a U.S. corporation as a person, does that include the officers of the corporation, the employees, all transactions, everything? So if you're just, if you work for McDonald's and McDonald's is owned by somebody else who also owns a telecom, can you then be spied on legally?
Any or all of the above. It depends on the determination of the FISA court, and because we have basically no ability to see anything that happens there, we don't know what they allow and what they don't allow. Generally, though, it would be monitoring the actions in the general criminal context of the principals of the business, the managerial people, the owners, and up.
Well, I mean, that's the idea. That's what we're that's not what we're concerned about, though. We're concerned about abuse of the power.
Yeah.
You know. And monitor for other reasons, like if you're an animal rights activist or something.
Exactly. And because of the lack of transparency, and that's one of the reasons that transparency needs to come to the FISA court, but in a way that still protects their ability to conduct operations that are ongoing. It's going to be a delicate balance, and it's always going to have, I think, a lot of conflict, no matter what the solution happens to be. I think the ACLU had actually proposed a fairly reasonable answer, and that's been turned down, so it's now up to the next step. All the way in the back.
Besides encrypting everything, is there any safe way to communicate?
In person, face to face.
In the middle of a public park.
Exactly.
In Swahili.
Back there.
Since you said earlier, you know, our recourse against this is talking to our politicians, and they don't listen to us anyways. Is there any civil disobedience we can do to mess up the system?
I flooding the system with traffic is.
Is there, you know, if we pick up the phone and we go bomb, you know,
put a terrorist string at the end of every email.
They call to Afghanistan every month or two.
Bomb.
The NSA has been rumored to use keyword triggering, you know, computer-based speech recognition, that type of stuff on the phone calls and their wireless reception. I don't know that you'd be able to flood the system in that manner, and I certainly wouldn't advocate, you know, committing treason or anything like that in order to prove a point. But
freedom of speech is not treason.
That's true.
You can get charged with sedition.
On the subject of encryption, and I know this is more of a technical than legal question, but you seem to know a lot of background information. How easy is it for the NSA to break strong encryption?
I have absolutely no answer to that question.
They're required, if the encryption was made here in the U.S., they're required to have a key for it.
No, that's true.
No, we can verbally exchange keys, and I can send you encrypted messages all day long, and they can never get them unless they can read the numbers that I gave them.
All the way in the back.
Are there any controls over what they can do with the information once they've gained it? If they get some information, are they allowed to give it to their political party to further their political party's aim, or that sort of thing?
There are no limitations in the law that prevent them from distributing the information how they see fit. The only limitation that would come into play would be the limitation on use in court, which, you know, doesn't do very much to help you if your communication is, you know, your secret proceedings on how to take down the opposite political party, or, you know, how to, you know, destroy their position.
So they would have 33 days to wiretap their political opponents' phones, looking to see if they've got messages or other, you know, immoral things that they're doing that they could then release to their political party.
They wouldn't have 30 days. They would have a week. But if they had a reason to substantially claim the basis, yes.
We talked around it for a good portion of this. Would you speak to the difference? At some points in time, the government wears the hat of war power, intelligence, and spying, and sometimes the government wears the hat of law enforcement. Would you speak to the differences between that?
It has to do a lot with the internal operation, and that's the problem with FISA. FISA was designed to try to deal with the external issue. To protect our borders, to protect our government, to protect our nation and our people. It was not really designed to be a law enforcement tool, but it suddenly became useful as a law enforcement tool when people were doing things that dealt with foreign entities. And as we've become more connected than we were in 1970, it's made it a lot more useful of a law for that purpose than it ever was. Did that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay.
Was there substantial profit or a reduction of cost associated with telecom complying? Because we're talking about a Republican president and a Democrat House and Senate that did this. So some bipartisan issue coerced this somehow.
I'm not aware that anybody got a discount in anything that they did. And it actually seems it would be more expensive for a company to maintain the equipment necessary to split all their communications and to provide facilities, and it seems like they're going through an added cost there more than
follow the money, but I wouldn't know how to do that.
Yeah.
Well, I think if follow the money comes by not being intimidated or backlash against one thing.
No. Yeah. And then at the same time, they also have to go through proceedings to authorize things before the FCC and to allow them to do certain things. And that might grease the situation, that type of thing. So, just behind you.
I don't know a whole lot about prepaid cell phones. Do those offer any kind of protection?
Some of the prepaid cell phones don't require any information to set them up. Some do. But you've got to remember that if you get a cell phone and you make the same series of calls on it to the same group of people that you made with another phone, monitoring the information on who gets called from whom makes that easy to connect back.
I'm pretty sure they can, without warrants, at all times monitor radio communications that are open anyway. And aren't all cell phones just open radio transceivers? I mean,
I believe now the new digital ones are keyed in some way, but that key may be open to the government. I'm not certain on that.
As far as that goes, yes, all cell phone transmissions are radio transmissions, but they're typically encrypted in some way.
They are.
It's been quite a while since it used to be that most cell phones were unencrypted. Just there were some had, you know, just different methods of modulating that radio carrier. But currently, probably. My guess is that at least 99% of all current cell phone conversations are encrypted.
Until it reaches the final telephone network. By the time that office we were looking
so
at.
So a ham can't listen in.
Exactly.
And you've got to remember, back in the time when we had analog cell phones and they were easily monitored, we had people who monitored congressional officers and staff members' communications. And we suddenly got really great laws that put civil and criminal penalties to that activity. So having your communication overheard in that manner allows you to go after the person who did it.
Can I ask something else?
Sure.
All these time limits, 7 days, 30 days, whatever, number of hours in some cases. Mm-hmm. What happens if they're not granted at the end of that? Do they have to destroy the data that they've accumulated, or they just stop and then they can start another period the next day? Or how does that work?
They just have to stop, and there is nothing to prevent them from starting it again if they decide that they have a different ground to monitor you.
I could be wrong about that, but I've heard several different directions that if they don't give permission, they're required to destroy the evidence they've collected so far. Of course, that doesn't mean they do. They demonstrated willingness to break the law already.
Exactly. It may be an administrative regulation that they have that's part of their internal policies and procedures to destroy that. I've read through the FISA a couple of times to try to get ready for this and did not find anything that required them to toss that out. We had somebody all the way in the back, and then I'll come back over here. Okay, over here.
Yeah, but why? The question wasn't that it does happen, but who benefits? Like, if
well,
it becomes increasingly
well, it's going to the government and the government and the Congress
will
benefit by
right.
Who's the least compliant company?
It's hard to know because all the information is kept in secret. I am aware that one of the cell phone companies here in the South blatantly refused. I believe it was Cellular South, which is Memphis, Mississippi, and Florida Panhandle, I believe.
I got a Verizon phone for sale.
Yes.
Talk about this, the 15-day time limit when war is declared on totally open surveillance. Does that time limit apply to the time that the search is actually executed or the time that the communications happen?
It's the 15-day window starts from the declaration of war, and it sort of goes back to the are you now or have you ever been a communist type theory of government. If they decide that you're a threat because we've declared war, then they get to monitor you for 15 days after the declaration of war.
Right, but with these splitters, they could just record all the data and then later on, 6 months later, decide that they want to look at that window.
That's if they're logging that information and they're storing it for that period of time. Now, what they do have to do is make the certification. Either the Attorney General has to make it or the FISA court, that they have reasonable grounds to suspect and monitor your communications. They can't just blanket listen to everybody and run keyword searches against everybody in San Francisco.
Legally.
That's not provided for in FISA. Yes.
So if we can monitor all the other countries' information, I would imagine that they have capability to do that for us. What is the interaction, if someone in France monitors a U.S. conversation and gets some information, what's the legality of using that in the U.S.?
If the traffic goes through France and it was legally gathered in France, then you'd be able to use it here.
I work for a CLAT. Is there any way to actually tell if where I work is complying with this or if they're not? Well, I mean, obviously, if it's in the, free AT&T or another company like that, which is almost necessary. Can I tell if my company is or not?
It's my understanding from the way the Folsom setup was arranged, kind of looking through the tech documents there, that the secret room equipment never sent any message. It was simply receive only, and it was basically a sink for everything that came through the facility, and you'd not be able to detect that. You wouldn't.
The company I work with has a secret room. I'd probably never be able to know.
Unless you stumbled across the secret room or saw, weird network equipment that you had no reason to have as part of your network. All right. Any other questions? All righty. Well, I thank y'all so much. And we will have an interesting panel as well tomorrow on digital television.